From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
So that historical break that somebody like William Gibson popularized with Neuromancer, these science fiction novels where you had people turning into beams of information and you had this amazing life online, what I'm suggesting is it might not be quite as exciting as being a cyberspace cowboy, but we're now taking that out into the world with us, so it is an X-reality.
Case was 24. At 22, he'd been a cowboy, a wrestler, one of the best in the sprawl.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far.
When I got to cyberspace, it rolled off the tongue and sat there in red Sharpie on the yellow legal pad, looking as though it had always been there.
So she's sitting there at her computer and her avatar is getting roasted on a spit.
This is why we describe it in terms of a viral thing, in terms of a parasitical thing, which eats away at us, but we kind of eat away at it. We're kind of part of this ecology.
Today, we explore the increasingly networked world in which we live. We'll meet the man who coined the word cyberspace, the pioneering science fiction writer William Gibson. We'll also look at the dark side of cloud computing and the X-reality that blurs the boundaries between the virtual and the real. But first, a look at the peer progressive movement. Haven't heard of it? It's a startup social movement, and the subject of Stephen Johnson's new book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. Johnson tells Steve Paulson there's a lot of political and social change happening today under the radar.
The one positive social trend that we have seen some coverage of over the last 20 years is the tremendous drop in all forms of crime across the country on average, and spectacular drops in cities like New York City. Now, this is something that's actually been covered quite a bit. It was in Malcolm Gladwell's Tipping Point, and there have been stories about it. But for the last 5 years, Gallup has been polling Americans each year, asking them, is crime getting better or is crime getting worse? And despite the fact that these tremendous stories of progress have been covered, Americans every year say crime has gotten worse. It's getting worse. It's getting worse. In fact, it's not. So even when they do kind of cover it, it's as if the human brain is just wired to ignore stories of positive news and focus only on the negative news.
And this doesn't really fit the model of what most journalists look for either. I mean, they're looking for the big thing that happened yesterday, or especially the big problem, the big crime, whatever.
And the other part of it, too, is even when you have a situation where there is good news, a lot of these trends that I'm talking about are trends that didn't happen because of one brilliant leader or one visionary inventor. When the iPhone comes out, you can put, or used to be able to put, Steve Jobs on the cover of Time magazine. When you're talking about aviation safety, which is just an extraordinary story, it's amazing how safe it is to fly in a commercial airplane now. You're more likely to be elected president of the United States in your lifetime than you are to die in a plane crash.
What? That's hard to believe.
Apparently, over the course of your lifetime, this is what they say now. I mean, it is really, really safe. So the problem is that safety record didn't come from one brilliant invention or one brilliant inventor. It came from thousands of people over decades tinkering with the system in various ways, some of them working for the airlines, some of them working for the airplane manufacturers, some of them working for the government. And that's the problem, is when you have that record of success, you can't put 1,000 engineers on the cover of Time magazine. And so we don't hear about that story, and we don't think about that kind of collaborative nature of progress nearly enough.
Now, you have actually identified a new movement, what you call the peer progressive movement. What is this?
Well, I looked around at some point over the last couple of years and realized that there was this whole group of folks who I had been inspired by, who were doing really interesting projects. Some of them were working in the tech sector. Some of them were working in education. Some of them were working in local neighborhood community movements. And they all shared this kind of philosophy. They all believed in the power of what I call in the book peer networks. They were using these kind of decentralized networks with open collaboration, often with a much larger, more diverse group of people coming together to try and solve problems, usually working outside of traditional big governments or outside of the marketplace.
So this is not strictly a left or right model here.
Yeah, part of the weirdness of it, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is that this kind of peer network approach doesn't really fit the traditional stereotypes of the Democrats or the traditional stereotypes of the Republicans. In some ways, the best way to think about how this works in practice is to think about the history of a lot of the technology that we now use, the internet, the web, things like Wikipedia, things like open source software that's in a lot of the devices we now take for granted. All of those things were developed by groups of people collaborating, not working for the same organization, many of them working in actually university systems and think tanks and things like that. Some of them funded by the government, some of them funded by private corporations, but mostly they were working without traditional ownership over their ideas. And they were sharing kind of technologies and breakthroughs that they'd come up with and building on top of other people's ideas. And that kind of peer network collaboration created the internet, created the web, created the standards behind email, created Wikipedia, and so on. So when you think about kind of open networks of collaboration without traditional ownership, it sounds like you're talking about this utopian fantasy. It sounds like, I mean, I'm talking to you from California right now. Like, it sounds like something you'd expect from a Northern California commune in like 1969. You know, I'd be talking about weaving baskets or something like that. But in fact, that kind of collaborative structure, those peer networks, built the defining technology of our age. And so this is why it's such an interesting time to be thinking about the power of that kind of organization. Is we've proven now that it can work in the real world and it can really build substantial things that change society as we know it. What else can that kind of form of collaboration do?
Now, you mentioned Wikipedia, which would be an obvious example of using technology to draw from many different sources to make something better. Are you basically talking about an internet phenomenon here?
No. The way that I try and describe it in the book is that the internet is kind of a role model for this new way of approaching the world, for these peer progressives, as I call them. Some of the things that they're working on involve using technology and using the internet, but they don't always involve technology. The premise here is not kind of traditional cyber utopianism, where if you could just get the world on Facebook, all our problems would go away. Because first off, the world is practically already on Facebook and it's causing its own problems. It's not that technology is the kind of cure-all, but that we can point to the success of things like the internet or things like Wikipedia and say, look, peer networks worked in that context. What can they do in other contexts? For example, one of my favorite case studies in the book is a story about participatory budgeting, which is this amazing tradition that came out of Brazil in the late 1980s in the town of Porto Alegre. This was a city in the late 80s that had gone through these convulsive growth periods. You know, they'd gone from 200,000 to 2 million people in a shockingly short amount of time. And they had all these infrastructure problems. They had all these terrible corruption problems and so on. At some point in the late 80s, they decided that they would earmark a certain amount of taxpayer dollars each year to be allocated based on local neighborhood decisions. So neighbors in each community would get together and they would have these open discussions face-to-face about what the priorities were in their community. You know, they needed the sewer line extended. They needed more space in the local school. They wanted a playground built, whatever it was. And they would create a ranked list of priorities. And then the funding would go to fund the projects that the citizens had decided upon.
And obviously the city officials have to agree to this system then.
Yeah, they have to kind of open up some of the budget to just be basically allocated by the people in the communities themselves. What it did was it had a tremendous impact on corruption in a positive way, because it was so much harder for money to just disappear, because people were like, hey, we asked for that sewer line extension and you guys said it would cost this much. Where is it? You know, there was a kind of accountability because people had been involved in the process. And people had this positive feedback loop. They showed up at these meetings and they got involved and they made these decisions and they saw their neighborhoods improve, so they came back. They felt like they could make a difference. I mention this because this is 1989, 1990 in Brazil. There's no internet to speak of. There are no smartphones. This is the technology of people gathering face-to-face and having conversations. The internet makes it easier to form these kinds of decentralized, diverse networks, but you don't have to have the internet to do it.
Now, you also write about various technologies that are very much internet-based. One is Kickstarter, which is very hot these days. You are a big Kickstarter fan, aren't you?
Kickstarter is just one of those fascinating projects where it reminds me a little bit of Wikipedia, where before it started, if you described it to someone, they would have said, well, sure, that's a lovely idea, but it's never going to really work in practice. Here you have Kickstarter. It's taking a peer network to solve the problem of how do you fund creative work that is not yet supported by the marketplace. And in the past, let's say you're a musician, if you couldn't get a big record label to support finishing your album, you would have to go to some other large organization, whether it's the National Endowment for the Arts or the Duke Foundation or some kind of large organization that funds creative work in some fashion. Now, what Kickstarter says is, well, you know, yes, those big institutions are nice, but what if we decided to distribute the process of funding creative work to tens or hundreds of thousands of people who might like to give small donations, $10 or $20 or $50?
Full disclosure here, our radio show, to the best of our knowledge, just did a Kickstarter project. We wanted to fund a comic book about consciousness, and we put it out there, and we made our $15,000 goal with more than 400 people contributing. So yes, I know how this works.
Yeah, it's amazing. The economics of it are interesting, right? Because oftentimes people are giving $50 to support, let's say, a comic book that should not cost more than $10.
Right.
And by the way, they're not investing in these projects. So if you back a musician on Kickstarter and they go on to have a number one record, you don't see any additional return. There's no upside in it for you. So it is kind of a gift economy. You can get rewards and you get the signed copy of the comic book. And I'm sure you guys offered rewards for different kind of
right.
levels of contributors. But it's not a traditional kind of commercial interaction. And yet, here's this kind of extraordinary platform. And it is already on track to give more money away to creative folks this year than the entire budget of the National Endowment for the Arts. Mm.
So what about business then? I mean, does this whole peer network system change or challenge the way we think about capitalism?
Well, the funny thing about capitalism is that markets, as I talk about in the book, markets are actually beautiful examples of peer networks. You've got a lot of decentralized agents who are buying and selling kind of independently, and there's often a lot of kind of diversity in a market that involves a lot of open competition. There's a lot of different people kind of working independently. When you have monopolies, you have another problem. But a corporation is often, you know, particularly a modern multinational corporation, is often a very top-heavy, hierarchical, almost bureaucratic organizational form, right? So the marketplace is nice and decentralized and diverse, but the corporate structure is not a peer network. And so there are a bunch of interesting experiments out there in internal corporate organization making these systems more peer network-like.
Can you give me one example?
Yeah, I look at a bunch in the book. So for instance, Whole Foods. Whole Foods does all this work to empower the employees on the level of the stores. So a lot of the decision-making of kind of what the store should look like, what foods should they stock, what local providers should they use, is actually coming from the store level. It's not coming from kind of a national level. And Whole Foods actually has a very interesting compensation structure where they're much more egalitarian in terms of the way that they share the proceeds. No one can make more than, it's like a 20-to-1 ratio of kind of the highest paid to the kind of average employee, whereas most corporations in America are now like 400-to-1. It's just a flatter hierarchy, both in terms of decision making and in terms of the way that the kind of wealth is shared inside the organization. There's a really interesting study that was done looking at companies that shared these values. They started to call them the conscious capitalists, is the phrase they use. And these are companies that have deliberately created kind of that peer network structure. They've been much better in terms of sharing the wealth with their employees, and much more kind of democratic in their decision-making. And these companies have actually outperformed their more traditional corporate competitors on the S&P 500 by a significant margin. So it turns out that it's actually kind of better business as well as being kind of more equitable way to structure the organization you've created.
So is it fair to say, if we step back for a moment and talk about these various things, you know, what's happening in business, what's happening in some internet companies, that a new worldview is taking shape, what you might call a peer progressive worldview?
The beautiful thing about this book, which is why it was so fun to write, is it's kind of a book about something that hasn't fully happened yet, right? It's a book about something that is just starting. I wanted to kind of take these organizational forms and these ideas and give them some names. It's very helpful that we can kind of point to the idea of government, or we can point to the idea of a corporation or the marketplace. And we don't have to explain what we mean when we talk about these things. You know, we know government, even though each government is a little bit different, we roughly know how governments work. And so I wanted to get this conversation about peer networks out there so that we could start to say, listen, I believe in government in these roles, and I believe in the private sector in these roles, but I also think that the peer network can do a lot of good work in society. And by giving them names, it just increases their currency and it makes it a lot easier for people to take the ideas and run with them, hopefully. So I'm hoping that this book will inspire some folks to do things that I didn't dream of at all, which is the power of these kinds of peer networks, is that they can take you to places you never imagined.
Stephen Johnson is the author of Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think of Johnson's ideas about the power of peer networks? You can let us know by contacting us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us an email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, the man who coined the word cyberspace, William Gibson, as we continue our hour called Networked. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. William Gibson has been described as the noir prophet of cyberpunk science fiction. He actually coined the word cyberspace in his 1982 short story Burning Chrome. He took it even further in his most famous novel, Neuromancer. The first winner of science fiction's Triple Crown, the Nebula Award, the Philip K. Dick Award, and the Hugo Award. Why did Gibson coin the word cyberspace?
What I needed in 1981 was an evocative and essentially meaningless word which would substitute for me in a work of science fiction for space and the spaceship, because space and the spaceship were the arena in which science fiction had predominantly played out in my lifetime, and neither of those worked for me in 1981 as a place where I could set fiction. I wanted something completely new. And through a rather roundabout process, I found myself one day sitting with a yellow legal pad and a red Sharpie printing imaginary words in block capitals. And I think I had info space and data space, neither of which worked poetically for me, neither of which would have really had any legs in the English language if I had chosen them instead. I think if I had chosen either infospace or data space, we wouldn't be talking now. When I got to cyberspace, it rolled off the tongue and sat there in red Sharpie on the yellow legal pad, looking as though it had always been there. And I thought, I'll go with that. It was a hollow signifier when I coined it. It meant nothing. It was absolutely devoid of meaning. And that was also what I had wanted, so that I could then begin to fill it in fiction with meaning to, I hoped, the pleasure of the reader.
Well, and it meant that you had a chance then to not be Robert Heinlein or Isaac Asimov. You had a place that you could write a distinctly William Gibson universe.
Yes, and I don't know if I would have put it that way at the time, but that was actually what I was looking for and what drove me to coin it. There's the subsequent but understandable confusion as to whether or not I invented cyberspace, and I didn't. What happened was I coined a word, came up with a number of completely imaginary definitions and descriptions of something called that, but the word somehow escaped from my text into the language at large and began to be used to describe what we were doing in what we still, by and large, call cyberspace, if indeed we have to call it anything. I think if it's not already slightly archaic, I think it eventually will be, if only because the distinction between that which is cyberspace and that which isn't is vanishing.
Well, I'm really curious, because you said you had a couple of definitions of it at the time. How would you have described cyberspace in 1981?
If I had a copy of Neuromancer with me, which I don't, I could find you the paragraph in Neuromancer which does exactly that.
Cyberspace, a consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation, by children being taught mathematical concepts, a graphic representation of data abstracted from the banks of every computer in the human system, unthinkable complexity, lines of light ranged in the non-space of the mind, clusters and constellations of data, like city lights receding.
By 1991, when people would ask me to define it, I'd tell them that it's where the bank keeps their money, which it literally is. It's where the stock market is transacted. It's increasingly where your medical records are. It's increasingly where we do everything of any informational importance. And simultaneously, it has no geographical location and is global. And now I think we're over into another era of cyberspace in which cyberspace is colonizing the physical world in ways that most of us aren't entirely conscious of.
It's interesting, isn't it, that something that was entirely imaginary when you started has evolved and taken on, if not a reality of its own, an existence of its own.
I knew in 1981 that there was an internet, to the extent that there was an internet in 1981, which wasn't very much. I had actually had friends who, after like a really grueling ham radio-like learning curve, were sometimes able to connect their computers to the computers of friends in foreign countries and exchange messages. And I thought, that's going to be exponentially easier one day. And that was one of the observations that led to the creation of my first imaginary cyberspace in my early fiction.
A lot of your nonfiction focuses on cities. You've written about Tokyo. You've written about New York City. Is there something particularly about cities that you find compelling?
Cities are engines for the generation of emergent technologies. Once cities were in place, relatively few technologies emerged directly from rural situations. I think that cities are in themselves a sort of meta-technology. It's impossible to have a city without a deep and pyramidal substrate of technologies. The very bottom line being that hunter-gatherers can't do cities. You can't do a city until your society has technologies in place that allow it to reliably obtain and store food. That's the bottom line. And usually it would mean cereals or something like that. You need an agricultural base and a way to store, you know, long-term storage of cereals or rice, which enables you then to keep a large population in one place and keep them working on your city project. Beyond a certain number, and I think it's actually a fairly specific number, your city will die of disease and overpopulation unless you've been able to master sewage technology. And that nearly did for London a couple of times with the cholera.
things have changed these days. Technology, the emergent technologies that you're so excited about, that you believe are moving social change, have come up with a lot of odd things. What do you think about social media sites like Facebook and Twitter?
Well, I think that the internet is something, in the broadest sense, on the order of a city. I think the internet is the next thing we've done as a species after cities. It's a sort of plateau. And on that plateau, it seems wholly natural to me that we would evolve means of social interaction, that there would be places to go and places to be with other people. It would be interesting to know whether in 50 years, say, social media resemble anything at all the social media that we have today. I think that's probably unknowable.
In your collection, Distrust That Particular Flavor, the last piece is called Googling the Cyborg. It's a transcript of a talk you gave for the Vancouver Institute. In there, you describe the internet as your cybernetic organism. Can you explain what you meant by that?
In that talk, I described the advent of our myth of the cyborg, of the quasi-robot human. The guy with the chip in his head and various other accessories. And that's been a big 20th century piece of mythology for us. It pops up everywhere. It's very familiar. Little children would get it if you showed them a drawing of that sort of cyborg. But what I wind up saying in that talk is that I don't think we're going there, but that that is a sort of cultural symbol that we've had of where we actually are going. And where we actually are going, I imagine, judging where we've already gone in my lifetime, is somewhere where we are all, to some extent, interconnected almost all of the time to an unprecedented degree. And that mass of constantly interconnected human beings accessing all sorts of artificial prosthetic memory constitutes a new stage of the human experience and probably indicates some further direction, which I would assume is quite unimaginable to us today.
I know you've just said that a future, anyway, is unimaginable, but do you see technology evolving, and do you have any ideas about how it's going to evolve, how it will affect us?
I think that technology does evolve, but it's important to remember that culturally, we often use the word evolve or evolution in ways that are completely counter to Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, to which I am very much a subscriber. And I think that technology actually evolves very much the way organisms evolve, which is to say randomly, meaninglessly, and endlessly. We are not the crown of creation. We're just the result of a lot of accidents. That was Darwin's take. You know, that's at the core of Darwin's theory of evolution. And I think our technology is like that. I think our technology is actually random, completely, often largely completely random. And new technologies are called into emergence often as not by someone's high hopes for the marketplace. And they then arrive, and they either take off or they don't. But when they do take off, by no means do they go in those directions imagined by their inventors or manufacturers. They change things radically in human society in ways that no one ever anticipated. The biggest changes that technology brings to us are, by and large, entirely unanticipated. And then we're left trying to legislate after the fact to try to come to terms with rampant social change in one sphere or another. but almost never are technologies legislated into existence.
William Gibson is the author of Neuromancer, Zero History, and many other novels. His nonfiction books include Distrust That Particular Flavor. Coming up, we'll look at the dark side of cloud computing and the crossover world of X-reality as we conclude our hour called Networked. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. How much of your digital data lives in the cloud? Family photos? Financial information? Medical files? Many of us store increasingly large chunks of personal and private information in the cloud. And if that doesn't worry you now, it will when you read Rob Coley and Dean Lockwood's book Cloud Time, The Inception of the Future. Although the cloud's often described as a utopian digital commons, Coley and Lockwood see a dystopian side. Dean Lockwood explains cloud culture.
Cloud culture is the emergence of a new phenomenon in computing, the idea of the cloud, which actually there's a great deal of debate over how precisely to define what the cloud is. But essentially, on a technical level, the cloud is what happens when computing becomes virtualized. That is, the importance of personal computers is declining. More and more stuff that we access, software, our files and so on, is now being stored in the cloud, in server farms, which are quite mysterious places. So we don't need PCs so much anymore. We don't need to be carrying all this stuff around with us. We don't need to be doing programming. The dirty work of computing is now virtualized. It's elsewhere. And we can access the cloud, the internet, through whatever devices we choose, our tablets, our smartphones. So the cloud, it's really the kind of the shift away from personal computing to a whole other kind of computing.
Now, so far, of course, what you're describing is what its supporters describe exactly as the great benefit of it. You don't need to have that landline lock anymore. You can have all your information wherever you are. I hear a little bit of suspicion, though, in your voice when you talk about cloud culture.
More than a little bit of suspicion. Essentially, our argument is that this whole revolution in computing is a move towards a more total integration of the users of computers and computing devices. And it's a state of always on, always connected. And it does open up an immense number of possibilities for creativity, for collaborating, for working in teams, and for companies to network in that way. But it also is a way of harvesting that kind of creativity as well. So we see this as a way of mobilizing the multitude, you might say. The idea of the digital commons, it has its upside, but it's also, cloud computing lays that open to a certain kind of enclosure, a certain kind of control, is our argument.
Well, it kind of takes advantage of people, too. It gives the company the opportunity to harvest the ideas of people wherever and whoever they are.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, did you want to chip in, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, it might be interesting to just go back to our point of departure on this, which was a think tank report written in the UK, authored by a guy called Charles Ledbetter, and this was published 2 years ago. And it was endorsed by the Labour Party, who were in power at the time. And this is where this kind of idea of cloud culture starts to come about. The cloud and this kind of logic of computing is just one aspect of a complete cultural shift that this document describes and the government sees as really essential to the future of, well, the creative industries, but also the industrialization of invention in our everyday lives, so that we all become creative people, regardless of whether we actually are web programmers or photographers or whatever else. And yes, to an extent, we think that's great, but this is all kind of unpaid labor for a start. This is ways of generating the new ideas which can be monetized and extracted and utilized in various ways, yeah, we don't receive any great advantage for this.
I can see that there are a lot of different aspects to this, some of which are good and some of which are a little concerning. That article that Charles Ledbetter wrote, he wrote, and you quoted, I think, cloud capitalists will want to harvest all that they can from their clouds, which means turning you and me, our preferences and interactions, into pieces of information to be analyzed by algorithms. Do you see that as a depersonalization of the computer user?
I think it is a depersonalization. I don't think cloud computing and cloud culture is really interested in us as individuals. I think it wants to transform us into data sets. The philosopher Gilles Deleuze talked about dividuals, and I think that's precisely the word that we ought to describe what we are becoming in this new cloud ecology, this new world of computing.
I don't know which one of you wants to answer this. Maybe, Dean, you've thought about it a little bit. You've talked about this access to the cloud, this use of the cloud by us and to us as being similar to the Christopher Nolan film, Inception. Is that same kind of you don't know where you are thing?
With the shift into cloud culture comes a shift in forms of power, I think. So we're used to thinking of power as something that is exerted over us by something that stands over against us, an authority or a powerful body. And now, as you see in the film Inception, it's power that is actually exerted from within our desires, from within our dreams, and from within our aspirations. They're modulated, they're controlled, they're tinkered with. So I think that cloud capitalism engenders a certain kind of desire. It modulates our desires. It's a kind of non-conscious presence within our interactions in the world.
Does someone benefit from this?
I don't think there's any kind of Wizard of Oz sat there behind the curtain pulling the strings. I think it's more of a logic. It's a systemic phenomenon.
I confess I'm having a little trouble wrapping my head around it. I hear the concerns that you're expressing, and believe me, they make me nervous. But I'm wondering, well, first of all, is it even possible to avoid this? We're now definitely in a world where the cloud is a part of our daily interaction with each other.
That's right. I'm not sure it's avoidable in terms of older forms of protest, older forms of resistance. I don't think you can simply opt out or drop out of cloud culture. We don't come up with any fantastic ideas for resistance in the book. I mean, the book is quite pessimistic. In fact, it was really conceived as a kind of horror story, I guess you'd say. And we actually make use of horror fictions and dystopian science fictions in order to express this kind of cramped space in which we find ourselves.
It actually is maybe more easily understood if you use some of those illustrations. Rob, there's a chapter in the book called Parasite Regime. And in that one, you write that if capital were an animal, it would be a cephalopod, an octopus, or a squid. Now, all of those cephalopod, an octopus, or a squid are extraordinarily intelligent and sensitive beings. But I guess you're not using it as a comforting thought, are you?
No. Again, one of the critiques, I suppose, of this idea of anthropomorphizing power would be that it's a problematic thing to do, is to kind of turn capital into a creature or something that we fear in that way. But we kind of find this is a useful way of describing our relation with capital. It's not something that can be boxed off, if you like. This is why we describe it in terms of a viral thing, in terms of a parasitical thing, which eats away at us, but we kind of eat away at it. We're kind of part of this ecology.
Now that we have that image of the octopus firmly in mind, we ought to go back and talk about cloud capitalism, because with that image there, it seems a little more vivid. When you say cloud capitalism, what exactly is it you mean?
Well, in the first instance, these behemoths like Amazon and Google and these growing concerns, which have already found many different ways of capitalizing upon our connections to the internet. But they're just the start of it. This is a field that's open for new kinds of power, new kinds of allegiances or alliances between corporate and governmental interests. So it's not just about capital, it's also about security and securing the future against terror, against risk, against contingency. So one of the central arguments of the book is that cloud computing and cloud culture can be seen as a way of trying to inoculate vested interests against the risky potentials of inherent in the future.
But isn't cloud capitalism or cloud culture also an opportunity to bring people more together?
Yeah, and we think that's kind of precisely where the crisis of this new logic of power lies, really, that often the solution presented by forms of resistance is based on relationships, simply by coming together and by forming a kind of assemblage or a multitude. We structure some form of resistance by being stronger together, if you like. And a part of what we're saying is that those old forms of resistance, in a way, have been co-opted.
Turned against us.
Precisely. These kind of logics of power actually want us to come together and form relationships, because in doing that, we also kind of generate vast amounts of information. We provide these relations are also based on algorithmic structures. They operate within the protocols of the kind of network structures through which we communicate. So these are no longer realms which we can be completely safe in, if you like.
Do you both see this as a kind of horror story?
I mean, yes, but it's also a device. It's a way of expressing these concerns. One of the concepts we don't actually talk about a great deal in the book, but which we're interested in, is a concept of fabulation. What fabulation suggests is that it's a spinning out of a tale, which is a way of creating a truth, but it's also a way of testing the limits of truths and, to some extent, falsifying and dismantling them and finding out other potentials, other truths, if you like. There's a role for a kind of poetic approach, a fabulatory approach, using fictions in order to prise open this phenomenon. Rather than sticking too closely to its technical manifestations, we wanted to unravel the metaphors and the rhetorics that underpin cloud culture.
Dean Lockwood and Rob Coley are the co-authors of Cloud Time, The Inception of the Future. There's a famous New Yorker cartoon in which two dogs are sitting in front of a computer. One says to the other, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." It's one of the seductive qualities of the internet. We can reinvent ourselves online and create new identities. This kind of virtual reinvention is one of the subjects that Beth Coleman explores in her book, Hello Avatar, Rise of the Networked Generation. Coleman is currently a Harvard faculty fellow at Berkman Center for Internet and Society and the director of the City as Platform Lab at the University of Waterloo, where she's a professor of rhetoric and digital media. She tells Anne Strangechamps how our lives are changing in the wake of the digital technology revolution.
What I found was that increasingly people were taking the things that they did online, the time they spent online, the people with whom they spoke online and interacted, and it was translating or transitioning into their daily lives, their geographically located, their embodied lives, you know, your real life, your normal life.
That's so interesting because traditionally, or originally, I guess, we distinguished between the cyber world and the real physical world. We go online as though we're going into a different space. The idea that the web is virtual reality, as opposed to, I guess, old-fashioned, just plain vanilla reality.
Yeah, just and, right, real reality.
Right. But so you actually have coined a phrase for something about this new in-between space, X-reality?
Yeah. I called it X-reality because what I'm arguing is that we need to look at what we're doing with taking all this informational world that we've developed online, and literally we have it with us, or a lot of it with us in our pockets, with our cell phones. So we see, in some ways, a whole new landscape open up in terms of, with mobile media, with increasingly pervasive computing and kind of a ubiquity of media engagement, increasingly, we have this informational world around us that is traditionally thought of as virtual, but we take it with us wherever we go. So it's not as if you leave your computer, you log off of something, and then you go out into the world. You have your Facebook network with you. You have your maps that tell you things about a city in real time. You have all of this information, all this data that you carry with you. So that historical break that somebody like William Gibson popularized with Neuromancer, with these science fiction novels where you had people turning into beams of information and you had this amazing life online, what I'm suggesting is it might not be quite as exciting as being a cyberspace cowboy, but we're now taking that out into the world with us. So it is an X reality.
one of the people you interviewed for your book is this French guy who has an avatar named Guy, and he participates in an online experience. It's basically virtual cannibalism.
I was at an actual dinner party, and somebody said, oh, I heard you're doing research in Second Life. You should meet my friend, because he's a virtual cannibal. And I said the same thing that anybody else would. What could that possibly mean, to be a virtual cannibal? I don't even know what to think of that, because one would think baseline necessity to be cannibals, you'd need bodies. But of course, I was wrong. I meet this guy, and we never met face-to-face. We only met avatar to avatar. So I asked him, what's going on? So he used to be a gamer, and he'd heard about Second Life, and he went in. He found a group of people who were doing BDSM, which is bondage, dominance, sadomasochism. So it's a very rigidly scripted protocol around sexual role play. So it's this kind of extreme sex practice. And they brought it into the virtual world because there's this open space. They could have like these human-esque avatars, and they could recreate. They could kind of make a puppet show of the kinds of actions that they want to see.
The idea being that in virtual space, you could take sadomasochism to extremes that, you know, might be illegal in real life.
Exactly.
How does the eating play out?
One of the pieces of testimony that I got was a woman who was being eaten. So she described it. So she's sitting there at her computer and her avatar is getting roasted on a spit. I know. The spit, the apparatus that's cooking her, is updating her on her progress because it's a machine world. The spit saying, now you're cooked 60%. Okay, now 75%. You're crispy around the edges. It's pretty mad. And she had this whole narrative on how, well, you know, it actually was really exciting and it totally turned me on. My final assessment was two things. The first one is often what happens when we use mediation, because it's imperfect, because we don't have all the signals with the hand and the body and all the things about being together, often we amplify the signal. Often we scream to get attention. We're shouting to be heard. So Guy, who had what he reported to me was he had, you know, just a vanilla normal sex life offline. With the virtual cannibals, they just kept shouting. So they elevated it to this whole level where they were doing this kind of like ceremonial staging of murders, of these sexualized murders. So that's one side of it, that you get this amplification, and we're still dealing with that.
So you mean that in real life, this is a guy who might ask a woman if she'd like to have a drink at a bar, but somehow in the virtual life, he's somebody who instead says, can I roast your arm and eat it?
Yeah, that's more or less. In real life, he might say, oh, can I buy you a drink? And in the virtual space or in the mediated space, it becomes a command about the woman has to submit, and it really ratchets up quite quickly. I chose this very extreme example to help highlight some of the ways in which we can look at that amplification in other less overwrought contexts. But we do still see the same thing of a kind of over-amplification.
Wait, so are you saying that's a really extreme example, but that you can see something similar play out on Facebook or Twitter or in these other less extreme virtual environments?
Yeah, because think about it. When you post your holiday photos to Facebook, you pick the ones that are going to demonstrate that you've got a charming life. Here's your charming boyfriend or girlfriend, here's your charming dog. You're not going to pick the photos that show you in an unflattering light, unless it's really funny. You are curating toward a certain effect. And one of the things that we see in research and psychology and sociology and a lot of different places, and we also see it in journalism, in general news media, increasingly we're seeing reports that North Americans are lonelier than they've ever been, have fewer friends, close friends, than they've ever had before. And we're in this paradoxical moment where we're talking to more people more often, and yet there's clear evidence that we're more lonely and more unhappy. So if you then say, okay, well, let's just look at Facebook for a second, you feel compelled to show yourself in a good light, or at the very least, in an interesting light, because otherwise, why are you going to post the photos? You don't really like, okay, so here's me vacuuming, here's me eating breakfast. There are a couple like really artistic right. people who do that, and it's quite beautiful, but most of us, we're just like, no, here's me doing this excellent ski jump or whatever thing that's supposed to represent awesomeness. There's a continuum in your world. Some things are great, some things are not so great. But your persona on Facebook, it always has to be top of your game, and I'm given a lot of greatness today. And then your friends see this, and they're matching you. Everyone's kind of ratcheting up the game of, here, I'm giving more greatness, and look how super lovely my family is, because what are you going to do otherwise?
But if this is increasingly becoming this X-reality you talked about that we live in, isn't there a danger here that if we spend so much time in this augmented reality with these augmented selves, that ordinary reality itself will come to seem just disappointing?
It's not. It's not. I mean, we're all alive every day. It's actually not. What I'm advocating is both people learning better for themselves how to use these tools and to teach themselves, I don't have to be on all of them and I don't have to be on all of them all the time. Let me find out what I like best. I like a Twitter stream. Text is good for me. I'm not so interested in having pictures up all the time or this other kind of communication. Or I like Facebook and I'm going to make it an interesting world. But to actually take these augmentations and move them toward whatever our purpose is. So for example, a counterexample to the virtual cannibals. And the other thing about what they were up to is their claim was they were actually doing these things. They didn't say, we're pretending to do these things in a virtual world. They said, we can't do these things in the real world, so we're actually doing them, but we're doing them in this space where we can do it. And it's their claim to it being actual that I think we need to pay attention to as well, because I'm suggesting that these are actual things we're doing in terms of how we're forming these representations of ourselves, how we're communicating, and not only can people read it independently of us being there or not, but they're somehow important reflections and extensions of who we are.
Beth Coleman is the author of Hello Avatar, Rise of the Networked Generation. She spoke with N. Strange Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Networked. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.